Good morning. This morning's Bible reading is from Proverbs chapter 7. The heading is Warning Against the Adulteress. My son, keep my words and store up my commands within you. Keep my commands and you will live. Guard my teachings as the apple of your eye. Bind them on your fingers, write them on the tablet of your heart. Say to wisdom, you are my sister, and call understanding your kinsman. They will keep you from the adulteress, from the wayward wife with her seductive words. At the window of my house, I looked out through the lattice. I saw among the simple, I noticed among the young men, a youth who lacked judgment. He was going down the street near her corner, walking along in the direction of her house at twilight, as the day was fading, as the dark of night set in. Then out came a woman to meet him, dressed like a prostitute and with crafty intent. She is loud and defiant. Her feet never stay at home, now in the street, now in the squares, at every corner she lurks. She took hold of him and kissed him, and with a brazen face she said, I have fellowship offerings at home. Today I fulfilled my vows. So I came out to meet you. I looked for you and have found you. I have covered my bed with coloured linens from Egypt. I have perfumed my bed with myrrh, aloes and cinnamon. Come, let's drink deep of love till morning. Let's enjoy ourselves with love. My husband is not at home. He's gone on a long journey. He took his purse filled with money and will not be home till full moon. With persuasive words, she led him astray. She seduced him with her smooth talk. All at once he followed her, like an ox going to the slaughter, like a deer stepping into a noose, till an arrow pierces his liver. Like a bird darting into a snare, little knowing it will cost him his life. Now then, my sons, listen to me. Pay attention to what I say. Do not let your hearts turn to her ways or stray into her paths. Many are the victims she has brought down. Her slain are a mighty throng. Her house is a highway to the grave, leading down to the chambers of death. Amen.
Well, how did I get here? One man's testimony says, I never thought I was a candidate for adultery. I was committed to our marriage and didn't think I was particularly high risk. So how did I get here? The best description I've ever heard was by baby steps. I let myself get into a position of innocent intimacy with another female. Our conversations were just innocent about family and friends and ministry. But one baby step led to another and to another and to another. And before I could turn and run, I was in too deep. It's a story that could be told over and over again, time and time again. It was a story that was told 3,000 years ago in Proverbs chapter 7. And it's a story that will be told again unless we listen. But before we look at our passage, I need to make a few introductory comments, really. Last week we spent some time looking at Lady Wisdom, the embodiment of wisdom. And this week we're going to meet her rival. We're going to spend some time hearing about the adulteress or the forbidden woman in this chapter. And the first caveat to give is that this is not an exhaustive portrait of sex in the Bible. The Bible is usually very positive about sex. And when we come across passages where that's where it's saying that, that will be our emphasis as well. But this is not an exhaustive portrait of sex in the Bible, nor is it an exhaustive portrait of sex in our world. Just because in this passage it describes a woman enticing a man, it's not saying that things are always this way. I know in many cases those roles are reversed. It's not trying to pin the blame on women. The reason why it's set like this is simply because Proverbs is written to a son, and it's explaining things in the way that temptation in particular will come to this particular son in his setting. And just as we always do, we need to work hard to see how this applies to us in our situation. The second thing to say is that this is not just a problem for other people. We can't just wriggle out of it by saying, well, yes, I can see that this is a problem for our world, but it's not a problem for the church. Or that it's maybe a problem for younger men, but not for older men. Or even that it's a problem for men, but not for women. When it comes to sexual temptation, it's not a matter of are you or aren't you, but where do you have to fight this temptation? It's more like a spectrum that we're all on somewhere. Your temptation might be in lingering over the clothing catalogue, or in indulging in romantic fiction, or it could be an addiction to pornography, or taking strong steps towards adultery. We're fools, though, if we think that this isn't for us. One pastoral counsellor, David Powlinson, says that when you understand your subtle sinfulness, you'll never say to another human being, oh, well, how could they do that? We're fundamentally more alike than we are different. You may never have been an adulterer, a fornicator, same-sex attracted, or consumer of pornography, but you know with all your heart that no temptation overtakes anyone that is not common to everyone. But let's head back to that man's question. How did I get here? And see, firstly, we need to see how sin persuades him. We're transported to Israel, 1000 BC, the sun has set and the chill is setting in. The moon lends a little bit of light to our scene to see by. King Solomon is heading to bed, he's just brushed his teeth, and as he does so, he looks out of his window and he sees in the street a group of lads out for a walk. On they're not taking the evening air, their feet are heading towards one house in particular that is well known for its activities after dark. I used to be part of a church that used to be right next to just such a house. There was never much people coming or going from the front door in the middle of the day. But after dark, you saw furtive figures coming in through the back gate. In answer to our question, how does sin persuade him? We first have to say that it doesn't have to. He is a willing conspirator. This young man seeks her out. In verses 6 to 8, at the window of my house, I looked down through the lattice. I saw among the simple, I noticed among the young men, a youth who had no sense. He was going down the streets near her house, walking along in the direction of her house. It's the very same young man that we met in chapter 1, verses 4, the simple man. That's not the unintelligent man, just the naive, the uneducated man. He hasn't lived long enough to be wise to the dangers. And perhaps he's feeling the peer pressure of the lads being around him. He walks in the direction of her house. But it's there where our story takes a dark twist. Not only does he go to her, but she goes to him, dressed as a prostitute and wily of heart, crafty of intent. In verse 12, at every corner she lurks. The language there changes to the language of a hunt, like David Attenborough might use. She is the black widow spider, and he's the dumb animal senselessly wandering into her web. In verses 12, she stalks him. In verse 13, her ambush is sprung. She took hold of him and kissed him. She catches him off guard. She uses shock tactics to ensnare him. She has many weapons in her armory, catching him off guard and her appearance firstly, but chiefly it seems to be her speech that the chapter focuses on. She baits him in with promises of food in verses 14. Today I fulfilled my vows and have food from my fellowship offering at home. It sounds quite innocent. Just come and have a meal with me. It's a religious festival. Time to let your hair down. Enjoy yourself. She seems like ever such a good sort, really. She takes religion very seriously. And so she cloaks herself with a pretense of piety. Next, she flatters him. So I came down, in verse 15, so I came down to meet you. I looked for you and I found you, you gorgeous hunk of a man. You're so sensitive, so caring. You're not like all those other men. Of course, we know she's been wandering the streets in search of any old victim. But she flatters him. Ironically, her reasons for choosing him aren't for his good looks or for his intellect. Rather, her reasons for choosing him are for his gullibility. Next weapon she uses is luxury and sensuality. Verses 16. I've covered my bed with coloured linens from Egypt. I perfume my bed with myrrh and aloes and cinnamon. This isn't some cheap, dirty fling. This is a night that you will remember with the woman of your dreams. Not a cheap motel, but a luxurious boudoir. There's plenty. There's a little part of us, that likes luxury, isn't there? This lady is fabulously wealthy and prominent. There's another trap right there, the status that she might confer from spending time with her. Lots of relationships are like that. Less about love, but more about the status of being loved. But she brings out her big guns. Next, she taps into his deep longings for fulfillment. Verse 18, come, let us drink deeply of love until the morning. Let us enjoy ourselves with love. She promises to fulfill his deepest longings, to quench his thirst. We hear that sort of talk today as well, don't we? Our sex drive is just an appetite to be fulfilled, like we might fulfill our appetite for hunger with food and our thirst with drink. And lastly, she takes away any fear of consequence. Verse 19. My husband is not at home. He's gone on a long journey. He took his purse with money, and he'll not be home until full moon, until the end of the month. She says, we'll get away with it. It is a no-strings-attached, risk-free endeavour. He'll never find out. Notice her words are her primary weapon. She uses words to build up a plausibility structure in his mind to justify their actions. With persuasive words, she leads him astray. She seduces him with smooth talk. See, sin rarely comes at us dressed as sin. It comes with a whole framework of justification that makes it appear the right thing to do. And no doubt, as he was being led away, he would be saying, well, all I'm really doing is offering her her company, offering a godly woman a company who's been callously abandoned by her husband. But I want us just to pause here and think about what this looks like today. We're going to stop and we're going to think about pornography. There are some quite frankly terrifying statistics about pornography that I could give you that mean that we can't just ignore it. Statistics that should make us weep, if not feel sick. Did you know, for example, that porn sites on the internet get more traffic than Amazon, Netflix and Twitter combined? 35% of all internet downloads are pornographic. 1 in 3 users of pornography are women, and in 2006, the average age that a child first accessed pornography was around 11 years old, and that was before smartphones really took off. It is a pandemic far more pervasive than the coronavirus. And so I want to draw the parallels between that and Proverbs chapter 7. Firstly, it preys on the naive and the gullible who stumble towards it. Verse 7 could practically be written about the back of the bike sheds, couldn't it? I saw among the simple, I noticed among the young men, a youth who had no sense, gathering around the smartphone and jeering each other on. Secondly, does pornography stalk us? Yes, it does. It pops up in our browsers, on adverts, on TV, even in the shops. It's not content to be found, it wants, it actively promotes itself. Is it religious? Perhaps not, but it certainly dresses itself up as something else, something innocent. Much of what passes itself off as TV these days would be considered as hardcore pornography in a previous generation. Does it flatter? Well, yes, it does. Just listen to this quote. A man can keep in his mind a harem of imaginary brides, always accessible, always subservient, calling for no sacrifice or adjustment. They can always be endowed with erotic or psychological attractions that no woman can rival. Among these shadowy brides, he is always adored, always the perfect lover. No demand is ever made on his unselfishness, no mortification ever put upon his vanity. Of course, it makes obvious appeals to sensuality and to vanity. It gives false promises of fulfillment, our deepest longings for intimacy and pleasure and love. And here's the big lie. The big lie is that it offers sex without consequences. You can do it in secret and no one will find out. But that's a lie. Really, its consequences are life-changing. From a secrecy that destroys trust, an inability to relate to the opposite sex without undressing them, shame, guilt, addiction, the list goes on. Not to mention the wider societal impact of a culture that is gripped by pornography. Proverbs chapter 7 could not be more spot on in terms of its portrayal of these temptations. But the first implication of this is clear. Parents, you need to talk to your children about this before you want to, really. Proverbs is a father speaking to a son. It's no good assuming that our children will be safe. The statistics are overwhelmingly against us on this one. We're no longer in an age where we can just sit down and have the chat, or even just hand over to our schools to do some sex education. We need to be having conversations, plural, over many years, preparing the way in an age-appropriate way with our children, so that A, we're not letting the TV and the internet educate them instead of us, and B, so that our conversation isn't just so toe-curlingly out of the blue that it gets ignored. We need to be walking with them for many years, because quite frankly, our culture, our world will be pushing them in the opposite direction already. Now, I'm not so naive to think that this is only an area where the young are tempted, or even that it's only men that are tempted in this way, or even that we are only tempted in the area of pornography and masturbation. You may be tempted towards adultery right now. It may only be baby steps, moving towards an inappropriate intimacy with a member of the opposite sex. Who knows? You might even be further down along that path. As I said earlier, the question isn't, are we tempted, but where are we tempted? My best advice from Proverbs chapter 7 is to understand how sin works. Ask yourself, where am I most vulnerable? Where am I most likely to fall? Which of her attacks would fail me? Am I most susceptible to being ambushed? This is simply assuming that it would never happen to me. Am I most susceptible to flattery as she flatters my ego? Or more tempted towards sensuality? Do I have a deep longing for intimacy that isn't being met in Christ? Reading around this topic, there was one fascinating case study that I came across. A biblical counsellor asked the person to keep a diary of when they they struggled with pornography. And he said, do you know what? I don't need to. I know the exact time that it is. It's always on a Friday night after work. He used to come home exhausted. And the thing was that he wouldn't see another person the entire weekend. He had no friends nearby and no family to call in on him. And so he was deeply lonely and exhausted. And it was at that time that the temptation would be hardest. We need to ask ourselves, why are we turning here? What do we think that it will give us? But let me encourage you too that growth is possible in this area. Growth does not mean perfect purity this side of the new creation. Growth in this area might simply mean falling into temptation less. No longer accessing online material and instead fighting it in our mind. Not responding to difficult circumstances by falling into sin. Repenting more quickly is progress as well. And one area where we can certainly all be growing is in moving away from a selfish self-indulgence of ourselves and toward another person-centered love. So let me ask you, what will Christian growth look like for you in this coming week? Let's get back to our passage again. The young man asks, how did I get here? And we've seen how sin had persuaded him, but we also need to see how wisdom had warned him. Some of the warning signs that he'd ignored along the highway. The first we've already seen. Wisdom warns him by exposing temptation's tactics. That's why the father narrates this story to us, so that we'll be wise. Forewarned is forearmed, isn't it? But he goes further in verses 22 to 27 and exposes some of the consequences. Verse 22, all at once he follows her, like an ox going to the slaughter, like a deer stepping into the noose till an arrow pierces his liver, like a bird darting into a snare, little knowing that it will cost him his life. He gives three pictures of animals going to the slaughter. The ox is as strong as any animal, but is led by ignorance to the slaughter. The deer is as graceful as any, but it too dies when it's trapped in the noose it didn't see. The bird's speed works against it when it flies into the net that it didn't notice. In each of the examples, the outcome is death. Verse 26. Many are the victims she has brought down. Her slain are a mighty throng. Her house is a highway to the grave, leading down to the chambers of death. What he's saying is, look beyond her to the consequences. That meal that she promised you, you're the main course. That boudoir that she described is a dark and damp prison cell. That freedom that she offered is the freedom of a ball and chain. And if you want to be really scared by this, then read the tail end of Proverbs chapter 6, where it explains what happens when the husband walks in on them. If you're tempted towards adultery, think long and hard about the consequences. The grass is not greener there. In reality, it could mean that you lose your job, that you lose your spouse, that you lose your children, that you lose your home and your money, that you lose your friends and your respect in the community, even that you lose your own self-respect and self-worth. The consequences of this are death, are a life that is filled with death. And in reality, I am understating those dangers. If we look into the New Testament, sexual immorality is warned against in the strongest terms. If we are persistent and unrepentant in this area, then we will not see the kingdom of God. Some fear is a healthy fear. It keeps us safe. It keeps us away from that cliff edge. The next warning is in verse 11. See, I think there are hints here that all is not well at home. It says that her feet never stay at home. Even when her husband's there, she is not. She's obviously not enjoying the married life that's explained and described in Proverbs chapter 31. One of the safeguards against adultery is to work hard on our marriage. We're told to do that in chapter 5, verses 15 to 20. Make sure that there is an open flow of communication backwards and forwards between both of us. Enjoy each other so that neither partner is tempted to find comfort in another's arms. Wouldn't it be worth every year, perhaps, just picking up a Christian book on marriage and reading through it just as a conversation starter, just as a review for how things are going in married life. The next warning, a sign that we receive, is right there at the start, and is less of a warning, though, and is more of a wooing. Verse 1, "My son, keep my words and store up my commands within you. Keep my commands and you will live. Guard my teaching as the apple of your eye." See, we might read this chapter and think, oh, how restrictive, how Victorian. Why can't he just let his son be? Why can't he let his son just express his own sexual identity? But that's not the tone of the passage. The tone of the passage is of a father that loves his son dearly. As "my son" is an affectionate term. These warnings spring out of love. They come from a God that loves you and wants you to have life. Here's a stupid man and he thinks that he's on the path to life. And everyone else is telling him that he is on the path to life. But he's wandering into a minefield. And so the loving father tells him, don't go that way. That way is the way of death. God puts signpost after signpost in our way, not to spite us, but out of love. If you're not a Christian, you need to know this. There is no one that loves you more than God. No one that wants you to have a better life than God. Not your wife, not your husband, not your friends, not your girlfriend, not your boyfriend, not your mum, not your dad. God cares for you more than even all of them, and cares that you find life in its abundance. And so he offers a better pathway. Verse 4, "Say to wisdom, you are my sister, and to insight, you are my relative." Don't embrace the forbidden woman. Embrace wisdom. Treat her as your sister, your intimate friend. We'll come back to this in a big way in chapter 31, but we're not just to listen to wisdom like we might listen to a street preacher. We're to have an intimate relationship with wisdom on the level of a sister, on the level of marriage, really. We're to make binding commitments to her. She is to be our constant companion, the one we ask and allow to speak into our lives, the one who goes everywhere with us. She is the better companion. But not only is she the better companion, she points us to the best companion. And we're going to go out of our passage, and it points us out into Ephesians chapter 5, verse 25, where it describes Christ's love. It says, "Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her." Notice the contrast to the way the forbidden woman loves and the way that Christ loves. See, he is the one who left his home in heaven, not to prey on helpless victims, not because he was dissatisfied at home, not to use us for his own amusement, but to seek and to save the lost, to seek and to save those who are fools, those who've fallen in this area time and time again. Jesus is the friend of sinners. He doesn't have his way with us and then leave us. He's the constant companion. He doesn't come to devour us, but comes to be devoured for us. See, if you find yourself trapped in verses 22, he offers the way out. He takes upon himself the eternal consequences of our foolishness, our death, the wages of our sin. He steps into verses 22 and 23 for us. Like an ox, it's him who is led to the slaughter. Like a deer, it is him who steps into that noose instead of us. It was him who was pierced with arrows for our transgression. It is precisely for you, if you are trapped in sexual sin, it is precisely for you that Christ came. Well, wherever we are on that spectrum, we need Christ's help to escape, to break the chains of sin and to guide us away from the snares that lead to death. Friends, no matter how many times we've fallen in this area, Christ is always there. He always offers the handshake of forgiveness and friendship. He always is there to pick us back up and sets us back on his path again. And so as we close, let's return to where we start. And with that man saying, well, how did I get here? The best description that I've ever heard was by baby steps. So you might have traced, as we went through Proverbs chapter 7, the repetition of the words of steps and pathways and highways. You can find that in verses 8, 11, 12, 19 and 27. But it all comes to a head in verse 25. Do not let your heart turn to her ways or stray into her paths. Wisdom is not a one-time decision. It's a walk. It's a pathway. It's baby steps, small decisions, everyday decisions. And the question really is, which pathway are you going to walk on? And where will that pathway lead? You might be familiar with the poem by Robert Frost, The Road Not Taken. Essentially, he stands at a crossroads in a woods and faces two paths. And the dilemma is that choosing one path now will set the direction for the rest of his life. And that's where Proverbs places us, at the head of a crossroads, a decision of two paths to take. And the decisions that we make here, to listen to wisdom or to ignore it, will shape the course of the rest of our life. They will shape the course of the rest of our eternal life. The poem ends, I took the road less travelled. And that made all the difference. See, Christ stands with us at the head of those crossroads and says, take this path. Walk it with me. Take my hand. Don't take her hand. Walk this path with me and I will give you life in all its fullness. This is the path to take.